nothing happens. They fold right through each other like the other one is not there. That's the magic of a thoroughly uniform transmission line. The forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal, for the most part, never see each other. They pass right through each other like the other one is not there. Once you accept that, let me drop...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Once you accept that, the next step is I can psychically punch the guy wire with my fist. I can make what looks like a whole bunch of sine waves going up the tower. I've got a whole bunch of reverse polarity sine waves coming back down the tower, reflecting off the tower, and they're all passing through each other. If I do it with the timing just right compared to the length of the guy wire, I will set up a standing wave. That standing wave will look like there are certain places on the guy wire where the wire is moving up and down. There are other places in between where the guy wire is bending up and bending clockwise and counterclockwise when I view it side view, but it's not moving. It is not translating. It's just bending. Very similar to what happens when you bow, when you draw a bowstring across a violin string. And if you look at it with high magnification in a bright room, you will see a standing wave. The bow dragging across the string on the fiddle is making a continuous sine wave. That sine wave is going to the shorted end of the bowstring and reflecting back. And at some particular characteristic frequency, there is an even number of pulses on that wire, and that's the resonant frequency of that wire, so to speak, and that is a standing wave. So far, does that make some sense?
Yes.
I've now made a mechanical standing wave, and there is an electronic equivalent to that. Electronically, I have a place where the voltage is going up and down. A half wave away from it, there's another one. In between the two, there's a place where the voltage is always zero. That's because there really is, at that point, a voltage going up the string, a voltage going down the string, or up the transmission line and down the transmission line. And at that point, they're always exactly 180 degrees out of phase, because one's going up and one's coming down, and they completely cancel all the time.
But I'm fitted.
Those are the node points. If I take any 50-ohm transmission line, a 50-ohm signal generator, with a piece of 50-ohm transmission line, and I put a perfect 50-ohm load at the end, and I turn up the signal generator until I've got 1 volt RMS across my 50-ohm dummy load. And now I take that 50-ohm dummy load and yank it off. I went from a 50-ohm load to a perfect open circuit. And my signal generator in this experiment must be a pure 50-ohm signal generator.
It will see 100% return standing wave.
Yeah, that's not where I'm going yet. In order for this experiment to come out with the right answer, the signal generator must be pure 50 ohms so that any signal reflected back to the signal generator does get absorbed. It's got to be a 50-ohm signal generator. Choose a real signal generator and put a 10 dB pad after it before you do this experiment. So I've set it up so that there's 1 volt going into the dummy load, 50 ohms. I yanked off the 50-ohm dummy load. That end of the cable now has not 1 volt, but 2 volts. Whenever you open circuit...
Then it will react as it is closed.
Whenever you open circuit, the end of a piece of cable, from a perfect load to a perfect open circuit, if the signal generator is perfectly balanced to the cable, 50 ohm sig gen, then whatever voltage you had will double. You get twice the voltage on a 100% standing wave. What's happening is that you could say there's a voltage going up, there's a voltage going down. At certain points on that cable, those two voltages add arithmetically, and you get twice voltage.
Current at the end of the cable.
At the open circuit end, by definition, the current's got to be zero. A quarter wave away from that, the current that used to be there just doubled.
Just a moment. You have a 2 volts. The current's supposed to be halved, as the power cannot be bigger than the power of the transmitter.
I didn't double the power.
No. You said that we deliver 1 volt. At the end, we have a 2 volts because we have a double voltage. By definition, we should have half of the current.
We've got twice the current.
Twice the current, twice the voltage.
It's at the end of the cable, the current that used to be whatever 1 volt and 50 ohms is, the current just went to zero because I yanked off the 50-ohm load. A quarter way back from the end of the cable, whatever current was there, when there was only a signal going up into the dummy load, because all the energy that used to go into the dummy load hit the open circuit and reflects back, because the open circuit is a higher impedance than the 50 ohms, the voltage reflects back without reversing in polarity. The exact same polarity of voltage goes back, and that's one of the reasons why the voltage doubles. The current a quarter way back, whatever the current used to be, just doubled, because that point is seeing forward going current and reverse going current, and the two currents add in phase a quarter wave back from the open circuit. So all voltages doubled, all currents doubled.
Double the voltage and double the current, you have twice the power.
You have no power. If the cable is made perfect, all the power flowing out of that signal generator goes down to the end of the cable. The cable is lossless because it's a high-quality cable. It absorbs nothing. The end of the cable has an open circuit. It absorbs nothing. Whatever power the signal generator just generated, every single one of those milliwatts comes back to that signal generator. It is a perfect ohm source, which means it's also a perfect 50-ohm load. It absorbs every bit of it. If the signal generator was putting out 1 watt when there was a perfect dummy load, now that I've made an open circuit, that watt that used to go to the dummy load now gets absorbed by the signal generator. The signal generator will run hotter. It's the only thing in the circuit that's got lost. It must absorb all the reflected power. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Okay, I understand that. You're not going to have, at the end of the coaxial cable, you're not going to have a double current and double voltage. You're going to have a return wave adding into the signal that is coming out. So at the transmitter side, you're going to have a double voltage and double current, right?
Be careful. The double voltage and double current places along the cable do not happen at the same place.
What I'm saying is they are 100 degrees opposite in phase. It cannot be that I have 2 watts when I'm creating 1 watt. From the transmitter, I cannot have, with the reverse wave, 2 watts on it.
The signal generator is a pure 50-ohm signal generator. He was generating 1 volt when everything was matched. 1 volt went down that cable, hit the dummy load at the end, and got absorbed. I create an open circuit. The end of the cable, the current goes to zero, the voltage doubles. A quarter wave back from the end of the cable, the current doubles, because it's got forward-going current and reverse-going current in phase at that voltage node point.
That's the point where we have a hotspot.
Yes and no. If the cable has maximum loss because of resistance of the center conductor, that will be the hotspot. If my cable is made out of polyethylene and I'm at a high enough frequency, the high voltage points will be the hotspot. The end of the cable will be one of the hotspots. That makes sense?
Yes, it is.
Now, of all that power that the single generator was generating, when there was a perfect 50-ohm load there, every bit of it reflects back. The end of the cable has twice voltage. Halfway back from the end of the cable is another place of twice voltage. A full wave back, twice voltage. 1.5 waves back, half voltage. Every half wave, twice voltage. Let me start off at the end of the cable again. A quarter wave back from the end of the cable, twice current. 3/4 of a wave back from the end of the cable, twice current. So that standing wave and those nulls and anti-nulls are a repeating pattern all the way back to the signal generator. You're now asking me, does the signal generator see maximum voltage or maximum current? And the answer, it depends. How many wavelengths of cable is there between the signal generator and the end of the cable? If it's a even number of quarter waves, if it's a exact number of half waves, the signal generator will see twice voltage. If it's an odd number of quarter waves, the signal generator will see twice current. As you change the length of the cable with a trombone, the signal generator will think it's seeing everything between 0 ohms resistive and infinity resistive, depending on how many wavelengths of cable there is between the signal generator and that open circuit. So the signal generator If it was a network analyzer and I operate that trombone into that open circuit, I can make the network analyzer see open circuits, short circuits, pure inductors, pure capacitors, depending on the length of the trombone going into that open circuit or short circuit. I could do the same thing with a short circuit on the end, and everything just moves a quarter wave downrange. So as long as I'm reflecting power, does the single generator see an open, a short, an inductor, or a capacitor? And the answer is yes. You just tell me the length of the cable, and I'll tell you which one it's going to see. In 2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, in 2XJN. The only problem that I have with all of this is the presence of the magnetic part of the electromagnetic shield. As we're not dealing with the ferrous materials, the magnetic field extends over the pipe. If there is a solid copper pipe, I find it hard to believe that I'm not able to put my Gauss meter on the outside and do not see the standing wave point. And to exia.
When there was a perfect 50 ohm load on the end of the cable, will you admit there was a certain amount of current flowing down that cable?
Yes.
Did that current create an external magnetic field on my piece of hardline? When I created an open circuit or a short circuit at the shielded end of the cable, I now doubled the voltage in certain places, and I doubled the current in certain places. If before there was no magnetic field coming outside of the cable, and I now just doubled that current inside the cable on the center conductor, if I was shielded before, I'm still shielded.
No. I remember the conversations we have had about the Faraday cage. And that was when I was doing the experiment with the capacitor and the coil over the capacitor. And I remember a Glenn's statement, the magnetic field extends beyond the cage and to exist.
You've got to be careful now. Bear in mind that I described this experiment.
Transmission line, KC2, QIQ. Don't want to be misquoted.
Yeah. In my experiment, I made sure the end of the line is thoroughly shielded. If I'm now hanging a short circuit, an open circuit, an inductor or a capacitor or a lousy load at the end of a piece of coax cable, and the end of the coax cable is not inside of a shielded box, now, for the first time, I can launch all kinds of signals down the outside of that cable, and all hell can break loose. In 2XJN, K2RIW.
It sounds more clear right now. If Glenn can take a stand, please.
Got it, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, Dick, I got a different question for you, though, if you don't mind. Maybe just save a minute or two for me at the end. Just a quick question about the arc again. But I'll let you continue with this conversation first. KC2, QIQ.
We can hop back and forth on subjects. We're adaptable people. Go ahead with your odd question.
I'm sure you're probably familiar with the Townsend discharge, right? That's just a, you know, like an analysis that's been around, you know, like since the 1800s, about where they basically talk about, you know, the acceleration of the electrons and the breakdown effect between voltage and current, where just prior to the point of arcing, you know, basically that Townsend discharge kind of explains the process, you know, the avalanche effect between the electrons and basically how the breakdown takes place. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm looking over, like, even something even here on Wikipedia, where it basically just, you know, talks about basic gas ionization and, you know, how that whole breakdown takes place. But I don't really quite get is why would you really need the an external ray of energy to you know, to get it going, when it looks like you know, mainly from just like say the Townsend discharge, that basically voltage by itself, you know, across a gas will eventually create that discharge, you know, once that sufficient voltage has been reached, and then the that acceleration takes place. In other words, why would you really need an external form of energy to get it going? Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me show you an experiment that I did that'll give you a partial answer. If I put the two gaps on the Wimhurst machine close enough together, I can get a discharge at, let's say, 27 kilovolts. I'm a little bit less than 1 centimeter apart. I own an electrostatic voltmeter. It's a great big object. It's about a foot and a half cube. It's got a great big, what looks like a Dawson Val edge meter in the front, but it's really a mechanism inside with a spring and a couple of plates that get repelled with high voltage. So I got this electrostatic voltmeter that can measure very accurately 30 kilovolts, and it draws zero current. It has an input impedance of infinity. Because you're putting voltage on plates, the electrostatic repulsion of the equal voltage on both plates, working against the spring, moves the needle, and you measure voltage. So I set the machine such that, and I set the gap, and I've got these two leads going over to the electrostatic voltmeter, and I set it so that I get a spark at 27 kilovolts. Now I run the experiment. I very slowly turn the Wimshurst machine. I go to 25 kilovolts, nothing happens, 26 kilovolts, 27 kilovolts, I get an arc. All right, I decide to repeat it. I go to 25 kilovolts, 26 kilovolts, 27 kilovolts, 27 and a half kilovolts, and for the next 3 seconds I don't get an arc, then all of a sudden I get an arc. And I repeat the experiment. If I keep repeating the experiment and I plot the voltage at which I get an arc, I'll get something that looks like a slightly lopsided Gaussian-shaped curve. Each time I do the experiment, I get a slightly different voltage where the arc takes place, particularly if I do it with a real high-resolution voltmeter. What do you think's going on there, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, air is a pretty much a funny breed, I would think. You know, it's a mixture. You know, I mean, you know, there's like, what is it, like 20% or something like that. It's like oxygen. You've got some nitrogen inside there, plus some other things inside of it. And, you know, air is somewhat fluid, you know, that moves through there. So, you know, granted there's no fan or anything in between, but I would say that the consistency of air that you're getting between your gap isn't just exactly the same each time. And it can probably vary with humidity. It can probably vary with a lot of different things. So, and then, of course, you might get some corona that might build up in between from one time to another. So is it an exact voltage each time that will start the avalanche? I'm not sure, you know. So I would think that the gas is varying in between because it's not an exact makeup of air, where I think if you probably had a more exact, mixture of what's between the gap each and every time, I would expect the voltage gap breakdown probably to be quite consistent. But that's just an opinion, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Ionization factor?
None of the above. I've got these two probes set roughly a centimeter apart because I'm trying to break it down at close to 30 kilovolts. I'm going to analyze the air that's in that vicinity. We're talking about approximately 1 cubic centimeter of air is the active area. Give me a rough guess, Glenn. How many air molecules at standard temperature and pressure, how many air molecules are in 1 cubic centimeter of air? Over to you, Glenn.
A lot.
I'll bet you the answer is 10 to the 19 molecules. One with 19 zeros after it, air molecules. Is that small statistics? Hell no. That is big statistics. That air, because there's so damn many air molecules there, every single time the air molecules act the same because there's so damn many of them, the air is not the variable. The variable is the cosmic ray. If I'm right at the threshold where I do or don't have a free electron just barely having enough velocity that when it strikes the next air molecule 63 nanometers later, it either does or does not have enough energy to create ionization. Air by itself does not break down just because you put high voltage there. It is my belief that a cosmic ray or some other event, maybe I've got some minor amount of polonium or nuclear material nearby, some kind of an ionizing event, cosmic ray, nuclear material, something, has to free up a particular electron. It's got to ionize one of those air molecules or one of those gases present.
Question, Dick.
Yeah, but before you go to anyone else, can I just add this one? If I were to double the voltage to a point where you weren't at the flimsy threshold, let's say, so in other words, you put in 50 kilovolts on a switch each time, I think instantaneously you'd have an arc each time, don't you think, Vic? Or you think it would be inconsistent there as well?
No, you're right. It would be consistent. Now, let me finish what I was trying to say to you guys. So I'm right at the threshold where when an electron finally gets free, and he gets accelerated, and on average he goes 63 nanometers and strikes another air molecule, he's right at the threshold where he does or doesn't have enough kinetic energy, enough velocity, that when he strikes, he creates an ionization of the next air molecule. Now, what determines that minor amount of difference? That particular cosmic ray that freed up that particular electron, was he moving along the gap, in the opposite direction from the gap, or across the gap? Depending on the direction of that cosmic ray, he added or subtracted from the energy of that electron that just got freed. I'm right at the threshold where I do or don't have enough energy, and now I really have a kind of directional telescope. Depending on whether or not I do or don't get a breakdown at that exact 27 kilovolts in my example, I can now make a guess what was the direction of travel of that particular cosmic ray or that particular nuclear event that created that particular molecule of ionization. You see what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do, but I'm not sure I'm convinced. I'm thinking that if you were to have a voltage on a set of plates, and let's say you've had fairly consistent breakdown somewhere like between 26 and 27, if you were to probably go down to like 25 kV and then let it sit there and dwell with 25 kV on the plate, and then were to move up just a little bit more from there, in other words, allowing a little bit of the a little bit of plasma to build up from a little bit of like ozone to build up in that area, a little bit of ozone plasma, and then move up. I think you'd probably see a more consistent breakdown. I'm still of the opinion, here again, just an opinion, that the air in that space from time to time isn't as consistent as we would like it to be. Here again, Dick, just an opinion. I'd like your idea of the cosmic ray too, but I'm not really sure that how would you really prove that? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
A point, Dick.
I'm going to show you how I proved it. First of all, in 1 cubic centimeter of the active area of this experiment, I probably have 10 to the 20 electron air molecules, large number. So the variation in air molecules is not the major effect. Got very large statistics there. I can go down to 27 kilovolts, I usually get an arc. I go down to 26 kilovolts, and I don't get an arc. But I sit at 26 kilovolts. If I wait long enough, I get an arc. It may take 4 minutes, but it's going to happen. Every so often, an event is favorable to this particular device, and you'll get an arc. The only thing left to discuss is how long. If I plotted probability of an arc, in other words, vertical is how long it takes, so to speak, the inverse of how long it takes, versus voltage horizontal, I'm going to get a slightly skewed Gaussian-shaped curve. I can go a whole kilovolt lower. If I wait long enough, I still get an arc. I'm waiting for that extremely rare event where a cosmic ray just happens to ionize a path all the way along from the left-hand probe to the right-hand probe. I haven't done the experiment, but I bet you if I went down to 25 kilovolts and waited long enough, it may take a day, but I'm still going to get an arc. I think the random variable is not the air. I think the random variable is the initiating event. It is my belief that air by itself does not arc. Something else has to start the process. In the case of a Townsend discharge, let me drop. Well, I think a Townsend discharge usually consists of a flask with a partial vacuum at high voltage. You're down at the dip of the passion curve. You're down at the point where you've now got, in the case of the dip in the passion curve, you now have a drastically decreased amount of air molecules. Now you can talk about the statistics of the trajectory of the air molecules combined with the statistics of trajectories of the ionizing event. And now you're getting another very weird kind of event. And because your partial vacuum arcs over so easily, but so gently, in other words, it's not a great big spark, if you know what I mean, you now get this continuous glow that you and I call Townsend discharge. But I think that's a somewhat different phenomena from the zap that I get from my particular machine. Over to you, Glenn, and I'm going to go back over to John. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, Dick, but I'm still not 100% convinced, but I don't want to, you know, dwell too much. You know, I understand where you're coming from. But I still am of an opinion that I think even if you went to lower voltage, that you're right, that the arc will take place. But I think the reason that that's taking place is because the makeup of the air is actually changing when a voltage is applied across a group of plates in a spark gap area. That corona will eventually build up over time. So actually the makeup of the air actually between that high voltage is actually changing over time. And that curve that you might be getting is actually the curve of corona buildup between the plates, which eventually will cause that acceleration and then that breakdown to occur. But no, thanks for the explanation, Dick. And well, I guess I'll have to look into this one further. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me warn you, Glenn, I'm not positive on this one. This is not my area of expertise. I'm just telling you what I observe, and just like Wesley has a model in his head as to how a quarter-wave and half-wave antenna works, and that model to him works. I have a model in my head that seems to work most of the time on what I think is happening here. I'm not positive. I'd not stake my life on this one. I've got a bunch of opinions, and as you read various things, you don't get a clear answer on this one. John, you had a question or a comment. You got it, John. K2LIW.
I have another one that I didn't ask.
Okay, Dick. What if we were to put your electrodes in a hermetically sealed glass tube with the same air, and maybe two of them, and put them in two different orientations, and see if they both arc at the same time with the exact same spacing, with the exact same air in it? We won't have any air motion or anything to disturb it. Then at least you might be able to get a little closer to resolution.
Oh, let me tell you about an event that I witnessed one night when my TVRO, television receive only terminal, was working well. And I'm watching NASA Select 10 years ago. And the space shuttle at nighttime was flying over Brazil. And there's a thunderstorm going on across most of the country of Brazil. So the astronauts are sleeping, the camera is rolling continuously, the camera is aimed outside the space shuttle, and they're flying over Brazil. And I'm watching lightning flashes across Brazil. I see one in Sao Paulo, I see one in Rio de Janeiro, I see one on the left-hand side of the country, I see one right-hand side of the country. Flash, 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 I see that. All of a sudden, I watch and I saw about 10 flashes across the whole damn country, almost simultaneously, within the same millisecond. A whole bunch of flashes all at once. I said to myself, how the hell can that happen? Some of those portions of that country are 1,000 miles apart. How did they flash? I mean, 1,000 miles is a 60th of a second at the speed of light. And I'm looking at something that looked like a millisecond. I am convinced that in many cases, a lightning bolt, a lightning flash, a thundercloud is initiated by a cosmic ray. I am convinced that occasionally a great big event takes place a zillion miles away in space, and a great big cloud of cosmic rays comes at the Earth as one great big burst. And that burst of cosmic rays, I think, hit the whole damn country of Brazil essentially simultaneously. And each one of those individual cosmic rays created a whole cascade of high-energy particles coming out. I mean, whenever you set up a gamma-ray experiment in space, no matter how you set up the experiment, it's just a matter of time before your cosmic ray telescope on your spacecraft sees an event that saturates the detector. No matter how big you make the detector, an event will eventually happen that saturates it. Every so often, something goes on in space, like maybe it's a pair of black holes or a pair of neutron stars coming together. Every so often, Mother Nature creates an event that's just out of this world. And one of those events occurs. You get a cloud of stuff hitting the whole damn country of Brazil simultaneously. And I saw that event happen at least on one occasion while watching that NASA Select, by watching the space shuttle flying over Brazil during a thunderstorm. So, can you get simultaneous events separated by 1,000 miles because of cosmic rays, the exact same pulse of cosmic rays? It may be a slightly rare event, but I'm almost positive the answer is yes. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Very interesting. I wish I could have seen that. That must have been some display. But I was just thinking that if we had two of those flash tubes, if they would both fire at the same time with the same voltage. And interesting enough that if you bring the voltage down by 1 kilovolt, now it takes longer for that arc to happen. Now, cosmic rays are pretty much around us all the time. So maybe what Glenn is saying about that buildup on the electrodes, that may be true too. It could go either way. But I think if we tried different orientations of the tubes, if it's cosmic rays, they're going to fire at different times. They wouldn't fire together. Where if it's the buildup on the elements, they would probably fire at the same time if they're constructed carefully enough.
Now I'm going to tell you how a few of the early cosmic ray telescopes were made. Assume that I've got a whole bunch of very small Geiger tubes, and I set up a huge volumetric array of them. I got a whole lot of them along the x-axis, a whole lot of them along the y-axis, a whole lot of them along the z-axis. And I filled up this cube with Geiger tubes. And I've got a whole bunch of coincidence detectors connected to those Geiger tubes. And now an event happens where a cosmic ray comes down the x-axis. And along the x-axis, if he takes a straight path, he's going to go through 5 consecutive Geiger tubes, and he will do that periodically. And if the cosmic ray comes in at some other angle during that microsecond or nanosecond, he's going to fire another group of Geiger tubes that are along another line. By having the right kind of coincidence detectors, and they all fire within the nearest fraction of a microsecond, and they all are in a particular row or line or column, if you know what I mean, I now know the direction of arrival of that particular cosmic ray. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, forming that type of matrix, you should be able to get a perfect direction. That sounds right to me. Also, I have a procurement question that you or Glenn may be able to answer when we get to a different subject.
I'd like to quickly ask my question.
Now, can you get simultaneous events if the particular cosmic ray is potent enough to penetrate a whole string of Geiger tubes? Absolutely. If it was a real weak one, and he went into the first Geiger tube, did his ionization, flashed his little bit of voltage, and died there, and doesn't flash any other. And by the way, each of those Geiger tubes is really a spot gap that's below the normal firing voltage. And you sit there and wait until something fires it. So, by the same token, when I set the voltage between my two probes at any voltage I want to, even if I'm 1,000 or 2,000 volts lower than the normal 27 kilovolts, it's going to give me a fairly reliable arc. If I wait long enough, I think I'm going to get an arc. Now, that's my belief on that. What do you think, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RAW?
Yeah, I am pretty sure if you wait long enough, you're definitely going to get an arc. Exactly the cause of the time, I think it's more chemical makeup. But, you know, there again, my experience, I've done a lot of experience with measuring voltage breakdowns and, arcing distances, mainly for, just designing things that have to go up in altitude, coatings, putting in gases, SF6, other things, nitrogen gases. To prevent these sort of things, but they are interesting. In and as I said, they're very, very. If you have an arcing problem, sometimes they're very difficult to troubleshoot because of their inconsistency in the voltages that they take place at. It's always a problem, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If we surrounded it with a heavy enough lead shield, Dick, do you think the cosmic ray would still penetrate? Would you get an arc or no arc?
Okay, let me go back to what Glenn is saying first. When you and I build a high-voltage power supply, Glenn, particularly if I'm building a high-voltage power supply for a traveling wave tube, and I'm running 10 or 12 kilovolts, and if I don't carefully choose the materials that I use within the potting materials of that high voltage power supply, where minor amounts of corona are taking place, chemical changes are taking place, the materials are changing their properties, and eventually I'm going to draw a big ugly black arc and all hell breaks loose. So chemical changes of the air, the materials nearby, and whatever, absolutely, that can take place. However, between my air gap, where I've got nothing but stainless steel and air, am I getting a chemical change? I'm not so sure. It doesn't require it. Those individual Geiger tubes that eventually fired, telling me that my cosmic ray telescope said that a signal just came from straight overhead because it fired that particular string of Geiger tubes. Inside of those Geiger tubes, I'm not getting a chemical change versus time. I've got a high voltage between each one of those anodes and cathodes, and when a cosmic ray goes through there, it ionizes that gas, I get a current flow for a period of time, and they all line up in a particular way in my simultaneous detectors, and I figure out which direction was the direction of arrival. So if I'm careful enough to choose the materials, and you do that in the side of Geiger tubes and scintillation counters and whatever, so that even though high voltage is present, no real change is happening of the gases and insulators and so on. If I choose the right materials, there doesn't have to be a change in time. It's now Mother Nature that's creating the event, and I can see the simultaneity of a particular direction of arrival, and that's what makes a cosmic ray telescope. So it can happen both ways. With the wrong materials and wait long enough, the materials are going to change due to corona effects and whatever. But if I use the right materials, I'm pretty sure I can...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With the right materials, I'm pretty sure I can make a real cosmic ray telescope. People have done that. I know you wanted to ask a question on this one, John. Go ahead, John.
And something said later, Dick.
Why don't you add it right now?
I guess one of the other reasons I'm kind of doubtful is just because of the... A arc itself will generate X-rays and a cornucopia of stuff when that arc takes place. And if you have two spark gaps next to each other, let's say one at a lower potential, where you think it's just before the threshold, and then you take the one next to it and you increase the voltage on it and cause that one to fire. I've never seen the one that fires cause the gap next to it to fire, if you know what I'm saying. And certainly one would think that the amount of energy in the one gap should cause the other one to do something if that energy was going to bleed over and, you know, add something to the other gap, which generally I've never seen happen. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, I accept that. And there's a bunch of explanations for what's going on there. By the way, if I used a great big chunk of lead around this thing, can I stop cosmic rays? There's a yes and a no to that. You can build a cosmic ray detector in the bottom of a mine, and the mine can be 2 miles deep. You'll have a drastic decrease in the number of cosmic rays. You still will detect cosmic rays and neutrinos and everything else. So every so often, Mother Nature supplies something so damn potent, it goes right through all the air, goes right through your mile of dirt, and goes into your detector. On top of that, Glenn, in the case of those Geiger tubes, let me drop it. Each one of those probes on the Geiger tube is fed by, let me pick a number, a 5 megohm series resistor. Maybe there's 5,000 volts on it, and a 5 megohm resistor. And the actual probe itself, it's got 0.01 picofarads. The total amount of energy of that discharge, of that Geiger tube, even though the cosmic ray went through that gas and gave you beautiful ionization, and it shorted out that probe periodically, the total amount of energy of that discharge is extremely small, because it's a tiny fraction of a picofarad capacitor backed up by many megohms of resistor back to the high voltage power supply. My detectors saw the voltage change across that 10 megohm resistor, and it said, yes, an event occurred in there, but the total energy of that discharge is very small. Now, in the case of an arc that I get between my two probes, how intense that arc is only a function of, in other words, if I slowly increase the voltage until I get an arc, I can get an extremely tiny arc if it's backed up with no capacitance and a high impedance circuit back to the power supply. Let me drop. You give me a 1 farad capacitor rated for 30 kilovolts. bridging the gap between those two probes, and you allow me to slowly bring up the voltage until I get a gap, until I get an arc. And when that arc finally occurs, the arc itself is a plasma of highly negative impedance material. Because that negative impedance characteristic of that arc is so strong, when the current goes strong enough, and the voltage goes down across the arc, not up, and it's backed up by this humongous capacitor, I'm going to make an electromagnetic pulse that will probably damage you if you were within 5 feet of that circuit when I did that experiment. Do you see what I'm saying on that one? If I had a second arc nearby, a second set of probes ready to arc, is there any doubt in your mind that when that first one goes off, it's going to initiate the event in the second one? The biggest variable is how many microfarads with how many ohms is backing up those two probes. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying for about the single source, because, you know, it's a negative impedance and it draws down the source, but I'm saying I've done experiments where I've used two HiPot machines and was supplying, you know, two pretty staunchy supplies to different gaps, and the gaps were relatively similar in each, and, you know, brought up one next to it and, you know, looking for arcs, and one would arc over, but there was nothing, even though they were driven by two separate sources and the arcs were similar and they were relatively nearby, if one went off, it generally wouldn't affect the other one, driven by a separate source stick. That's what I was actually saying before.
I have a question.
The biggest variable is how many microfarads were supporting the first arc. When you heard the arc, tell me how loud was the discharge. Did it sound like a 2-inch salute going off? Over to you, Glenn.
No, the voltages and the spacings I was dealing with, it looked just more like a little tick, you know, like a little ticking sound. And, you know, to really see it, you probably would have to turn off the lights.
If that exact same probe and that exact same voltage was backed up by a 1,000 microfarad capacitor at that voltage, tell me what would change.
Well, the impedance of the spark gap would break down, and then there would be more current energy behind it. So you'd have more current available, instead of just shorting out the energy from a high impedance source to having a low impedance source. The current would be available and probably burn the arc and the metal, burn quite a bit of the metal away on the on either end of that spark gap. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And duration would be longer.
That's also true, but the exact same voltage or breakdown from the exact same arc would take place as you put a big capacitor on it, with a slight difference because of the way the leader corona function starts. But if you put a big enough capacitor there, Glenn, when that arc finally occurs on that exact same gap, the sound you will get, the intensity of the light that you will get, the amount of X-rays you get will be huge. The exact same voltage, the exact same gap, and you'll probably burn up the gap itself. You give me a big enough capacitor that determines how many joules of energy you're about to dump into that arc. You put enough joules of energy into that arc, the instantaneous temperature in the middle of that arc will go to 30,000 degrees Kelvin, and I'm not kidding. Instantaneously, you will make more temperature than the center of the sun, so to speak, if you give me a big enough capacitor and a low enough inductance to it. And when you make that amount of X-rays in that arc, first of all, you're putting your body at great risk when you're standing close. But any other arc nearby, guarantee you will initiate it also. What you were doing is you had so little capacitance and such a high impedance back to that power supply that when that discharge occurred, obviously the fact that you just told me you heard a tiny little tick, the amount of sound that you heard told me exactly how many joules backed up by a capacitor you were dumping into that particular negative impedance arc. And by my standards, you had an extremely small energy arc. That's my belief, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I'd have to agree, Dick, because mainly the devices that I was using to create the arc with, you know, in testing for it, basically are HiPot machines, and HiPot machines are extremely high impedance devices, and they've got extremely fast current limiting circuits, where you can set them to like less than 1 milliamp. so that once the once something does take place, you don't do any damage. That's actually what it's there for. So in other words, I guess you're suggesting that realistically, to get that kind of a coupling effect, the energy in the gap would have had been much larger.
I have an answer question.
Glenn, out in Arizona, they have a great big testing facility where they create electromagnetic pulse to find out the survivability of military aircraft. Would you like to me to tell you how they generate that EMP, KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Certainly, go right ahead, Vic.
They got a great big bank of god-awful sized capacitors. They charge them at a very high voltage and discharge them across the gap. The current that flows through those leads, the amount of current that flows across that gap, and the amount of energy being discharged by this humongous bank of capacitors at very high voltage, jumping all of those joules into that gap, that makes the EMP. You and I are discussing with our gaps whether we're making nano EMP or kilo EMP. The biggest variable is how many microfarads, how many volts, how many joules, how much series resistance, how much series inductance. What's the instantaneous current that flows across that gap? It's strictly a function of the impedance of the source. We're not changing the voltage at which the breakdown takes place. We're discussing that when the breakdown takes place and it becomes a negative impedance plasma, do you have the local resources to dump the right amount of energy into that plasma? And if you do, there is no limit to the amount of temperature, light, X-rays, gamma rays, whatever. You give me a big enough capacitor, a high enough voltage, a low enough impedance, and a gap that just broke down, there is no limit to the amount of energy I can make for the next 5 microseconds, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn. K2RIW.
Interestingly enough, though, Dick, with the EMP, I imagine you've done some of that testing or been around it. Have you seen much effect of destruction to electronic devices? You know, coming more from like the power industry and a lot of the power circuits, at least most of the impression that I've gotten so far is that most of it really is unaffected. You know, most of, in other words, once we usually get a power supply that basically meets all of the standard IEC stuff, in other words, the surge, the ESD, HiPot specifications, and everything else, next to EMP, those kinds of circuits generally don't get bothered too much. I was wondering if you might have a couple of words to say what kind of components you've seen that have had a lot of problems. I would imagine probably receivers probably take quite a beating, and some other maybe sensitive digital circuits, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have not directly worked at that facility, but I've talked to people who have. There's a whole branch of electronic warfare, which is called HPM in the United States, and the Soviet Union's got another name for it. I've forgotten the name. We call it HPM, High Power Microwave. If you can generate a gigawatt of energy at an RF frequency, and the frequency doesn't matter, if you can generate a gigawatt of energy, and if you can do it for 1 microsecond of duration, you can wipe out solid-state electronics within a kilometer, and it almost doesn't matter how well it's shielded. You climb right through the shielding. Most of the work that's done at these EMP facilities is a function of how much of the EMP energy, the Compton electrons as they're called, get coupled across the skin of the aircraft, get into your wiring, crawl along the wiring, make excessive voltages somewhere that wipe out usually solid-state electronics. If you've got vacuum tube electronics, they've got a ridiculous amount of survivability. But solid-state electronics with a pulse coming down a wire, where each meter of wire is giving you a megavolt of voltage pickup, boy, that's going to give you a lot of grief with your solid-state electronics. And you burn out the guy's front end, he's blind after that. That's the main thing that I think they were worried about. Over to you, Glenn, KQRIW.
Yeah, that was kind of along the lines that I had seen. I know from some of the stuff that I'd seen, they were always worried about not so much just EMP, but was from some of the other effects, blinding of optocouplers. I know optocouplers were, they had to be rad-hardened, slightly different problem, but there again, I know that they were always an issue for us with, you know, the power circuits, were to try to get, you know, eliminate optocouplers wherever possible in those applications. And, you know, but it was interesting how the power supplies themselves were extremely robust. If anything, the controllers and things like that we had to do a little bit more work with, but relatively immune. But from what I understand, some other communications things, you know, certainly digital communication hubs, you know, I would imagine RF receivers and things like that were, like you're saying, were pretty much just vaporized. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KG2QIQ.
Okay, you put enough instantaneous power across the junction of the low noise amplifiers on the front end of a receiver, a radar, a communication system, or whatever, you can really blind them. And you can probably do it from a kilometer away. And you might want to do it with an RPV because the self-destruction on your own vehicle could be very intolerable. So with your RPV, you create this EMP, and then everything within a kilometer radius of that is blinded if it's got solid-state electronics. That was a real scenario that people worried about, and there was enough testing to say that that was more than possible. That kind of a weapon has a very deep magazine. You don't run out of shells, if you know what I mean, if you can do it electronically. I know you wanted to ask some questions on this, John. KC2, WGB, K2RIW.
I had a question.
A quick question, Dick, not on this subject. I need to buy a radiological sample for testing. I've taken ones out of smoke detectors. Do you know of a supplier or anybody I can purchase that from?
No, I don't. I know a man who I used to work with, who's retired, but he's on the other end of a website, other end of an email. I'll ask him, are you trying to buy a polonium source? What kind of a material are you trying to buy?
Right now, any standard source I could get, whether it be radium or whatever, just for a sample that I can reliably use. The ones out of the smoke detectors are just not enough of the sample.
But you want a predictable amount of energy, of a known energy density, a known profile, such that your particular nuclear detector will be confirmed that it's within the right approximate amplitude range of accuracy. Is that what you're trying to do?
Exactly.
Okay. Do you know what your threshold sensitivity is? That'll tell me something about how big a chunk of material you got to buy.
The suggestion, Dick.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, John, if you're willing to travel to Japan, you could probably just pick up a little soil around Fukushima and you'll have all the sampling you need. Just another joke, though. KC2QIQ.
Maybe I could pick up some at Indian Point.
That's kind of gallows humor. Go ahead with your question, Wes.
Yes, last time we discussed the capacitive coil, which was made from the coaxial cable. Left-hand side was connected to the bride, right-hand side was connected to the central conductor. Now, this coil was coupled, and this air coil, with another coil made from the regular copper wire. Now, we delivered the impulse from that primary winding, and the secondary winding from coaxial coil cable is receiving that signal. And because of the increased capacity, it's holding that longer. So before this energy is dissipated, let's say 30% of that signal is still in the coaxial cable. And then another impulse of 100% of the same amplitude comes to that and is trying to load. For the moment, we would think we have 130% of the signal on that coaxial cable. I'm trying to visualize how the saturation of the conductor is taking place.
The center conductor of your coaxial cable has a certain amount of length. It's connected to a load on one end, and the other end is an open circuit inside the cable. That really is a kind of a shielded quarter wave resonator. So when you put an impulse into that system, you're going to set that resonator ringing. If the impulses you put into the single, into the system, are timed correctly, just like any other kind of resonant circuit, you can build up a larger voltage. And if you kept doing that at the resonant frequency of your semiconductor resonator, what you've really got is a kind of an organ pipe. You, with your coaxial cable, you've got the equivalent, electronic equivalent of an organ pipe. And if you keep hitting it correctly, timing-wise, you can build up a pretty big voltage in there. What will eventually happen, if your coaxial cable was low enough in loss, that really means high enough in Q, and if the frequency of your impulsing is accurate enough, you'll eventually build up a big enough voltage that something in the coaxial cable will arc over. I think that's the first nonlinearity of that system you might encounter. You can arc over the semiconductor to the shield with inside the coaxial cable if you time it just right and if the coaxial cable is low enough in loss. That's my guess. OUS, K2RIW.
Yeah, because the time is almost ending up, I have a question for you. If you find a time next Sunday, I have sent you the article, Energy Received by Capacitive Antennas, which is what you like. Now, I have sent you the short version of it and the long version of it. And the short version of it stands about the factor of the energy accumulation over the level that is scientifically possible. And this article has all of the equation possible and calculation, and also the comments. Some of the comments are from engineers of science, electronic design, and some of the corrections still. It says that his calculation was right and was proven right. So it says, if you actually build this thing, it would work, although the practical consideration might be mess thing up. The infinite value of Q created by real-world coils would reduce the 100 times factor, which he states, 100 times the power. And to exit.
It's nice on paper to say I've got infinite Q. In the real world, the highest Q I have ever heard of in reasonable circuits before we get into laser-like things is almost 1 million, 500,000 or so. The right kind of a quartz crystal, piezoelectric quartz crystal, as a frequency resonator, properly mounted in a vacuum envelope, as a resonator can approach at least 500,000 and maybe closer to 1 million. That makes it an extremely narrow band responding device, and you've got to be hitting it at just the right frequency or the energy doesn't build up. So having the Q high, and one of the five definitions of Q is the voltage rise at resonance or the current rise at resonance or the energy stored per cycle versus the energy dissipated per cycle or the bandwidth relationship divided into the center frequency. There's four or five definitions of Q. Or the damping time when it's ringing down. I guess that's the fifth definition. So when you have an extremely high Q circuit, up until the point of something saturating, you can put what looks like a lot of energy into it. But to my knowledge, no one has ever gotten more energy out than you put in.
How would you picture the saturation in the conductor?
In the case of the coaxial cable, if the coaxial cable was low enough in loss, and I pulsed it just right at its resonant frequency, it's a kind of an organ pipe, a very high Q resonator, the eventual failure mode, in my opinion, is going to be the open end of that semiconductor, just like we had before with the signal generator into the coax cable, into the shielded box, and you remove the 50-ohm load, and the voltage there doubled. Well, the open end of that semiconductor of the coax cable is going to be having twice the voltage that's anywhere else along the center conductor, and that's eventually going to arc over. That's what I think is going to be the energy limitation if the coax cable is low enough in loss. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, thank you very much. Time is almost up. It wouldn't hurt if you read that article, and it also has a beautiful graphic in it. I mean, it shows two plates of the capacitor, then in between them, you have an example of the two additional plates with a coil and two additional, you're going to see that, and I believe you're going to like it. I would love to talk to you about it. It's kind of important to me.
And was that all in the email you sent me tonight, somewhere around 7:30 or 8 o'clock tonight?
There was, I believe I sent you three emails, two of them.